if the start of every real estate transaction is an accepted offer, I think the entry point for any attorney is really the purchase and sale agreement. That's usually when we come in. And for those of you who don't know, the purchase and sale agreement is basically the roadmap that takes you from the offer stage to the closing stage, lays out everyone's responsibilities, and most importantly, who gets the money if the transaction falls apart for certain reasons. So what I'd like to do is just guide you through some of the provisions that we're going to work with and give you some tips on how to get through them and get you some tips on what you're looking for as you're editing and negotiating these purchase and sale agreements. Of course, we have to start out with our lovely friend from law school, the statute of frauds, and you know, those awesome five items that we often overlook as, I think, real estate conveyancers, that, you know, this is contract law. They are enforceable agreements. We tend to cut and paste and throw these agreements around, but it all goes back to that statute of frauds. It goes back to law school, where you have to have an agreement in writing. You have to describe the property, who the parties are, what the price is, and a date for performance. One thing I'm seeing a lot of now are offers that don't have a performance date. They have something like, we'll close as soon as possible. Buyers are anxious to close, or it'll be buyers can close within 45 days. And so it's important to see those things in offers and then get them very specific in your purchase and sale agreements. To start out, you can't just jump into this. You have to gather your information. So after you have your client set up, after you have your fee agreement in place, review the offer. Talk to your client about what you see, what you don't see. Ask a lot of questions. Reach out to the realtor if you see something in there. In today's market, we're seeing things like, we will waive the inspection, but we want to do one for informational purposes. Talk to everyone to find out what they mean by that, because those things can cause a lot of problems when you're going from the offer to the purchase and sale agreement. If you don't get the information out up front, you're not going to do a good job crafting those provisions in the purchase and sale agreement, or really putting a focus on what the parties intended to negotiate when they did that. And once you understand the issues, you can talk to your client about what they mean and how you move forward with them. While you're talking to clients, collect all the contact information you need for everyone involved in the transaction and keep it in a centralized place. You know, you don't want to have to reach out to someone and not have that information handy, because I think the last thing you want to do is send an email, hey, I need to talk to you, what's the best number to reach you at? I think your clients are going to look and say, why don't you have that at the top of my head? And it may seem like something simple, but I've had it happen where, you know, a realtor reach out to me and, you know, what's our client's cell phone number again? What's the email number for that person in the transaction? So especially if you're the buyer lender's attorney, people are going to be looking to you to run the transaction, have all the contact information you need, have it handy, have it ready to go, and make it convenient to access. If you're driving to a closing, you don't want to have to pull out a paper folder to look for a phone number to tell somebody you're going to be late. So find a great way to keep that stuff accessible. And with that, I just like to, you know, get into the agreement itself. Now you're going to see different types of agreements. You'll see the standard agreements from the Boston Realtors Association, the Mass Realtors Association. You'll see agreements that attorneys create. So while some of the paragraph numbers might be different, you're going to find that the material is largely the same. And one of the first places I think it's really important to look at is, what are they selling and what are they buying? Because a lot of times a seller will include furniture. And if they are, you have to have that stated out. So when you get to the building improvement personal property fixture clause, that's the time. That's the place to say, this is what we're including, this is what we're excluding. A lot of times you have to talk to the realtor to see what the listing agreement said. Because what you don't want to have is have your buyer on the day before closing go to a walkthrough and look for the chandelier that was above the dining room table that the seller intended to take from day one, but it never got into the agreement. So just be simple. Ask your client, you know, are you buying anything with this house? What do you expect to stay? Are there any agreements for furniture? Know what it is, make sure it gets in, and really avoid a problem. And then that gets to bring up our lovely conversation of what's a fixture and what's personal property. And, you know, they take on new meanings when we hang TVs on walls now. And, you know, really flush those things out, because sometimes people will say, well, the TV's gone, but the the wall holders there. I thought I was getting the whole thing. So really just set your client's expectations from day one, put it in the agreement and make sure it's out there so everyone knows what we're doing. This may sound very simple, but check the purchase price. A lot of times there'll be negotiations that you're not involved in and maybe even an adjustment to the offer that you don't know about. So make sure the numbers are what they should be. Sometimes people will do that informational inspection and then come back and ask for something. And then they don't tell the attorneys everything you need to know. So not only though, do you need to make sure that the numbers are still the numbers. A lot of the offers that you'll see don't do the math for you at the end. It'll have the two deposits and then it'll just get you the total. So you have to kind of get a calculator out. So, you know, make sure the math works, look for reductions, look for closing cross credits, make sure it's all there up front, check the deposits. I actually just had a closing we were praying for the other day and the P&S said one thing about the deposits, but the realtors were holding a different number for the deposits and no one ever chased the borrowers to make sure they made the right deposit amounts. So again, you're up front, you got the math, just check it right there. One of the consequences if you don't check it there is the lender's using this. So you can get towards the end of, you know, the end of getting ready for a closing, and you get the numbers right, and all of the lender wants you to start amending agreements, and you don't want to go down that road. So take care of it way back at the start when it's easiest to do. Time for performance. This is always a fun one. Again, you know, make sure it all matches. Guys, Monday's a holiday, right? What happens if we have a closing on Monday in a P&S?
Well, you can't go to record.
Right, because the registries are closed.
Yep. So, and you're not getting money either because I believe the Federal Reserve is closed.
Yeah. So when's the best time to look to make sure the closing date doesn't fall on a weekend or a holiday, right? When you're doing the P&S with the offer, you know, just check it. Now, a lot of P&Ss have a clause that says something like, if it falls on a weekend or a holiday, we go to the next business day. And that's a nice safe catch-all. But wouldn't you rather be upfront with that? Catch it early, look like the hero. More importantly, in this just, I talk about this at first-time homebuyer conferences, and it just continually comes up. Find out if your client can be available. I can't tell you how many times I have a client that will call me and say, oh, I have to be at the closing? I just scheduled a trip to go away. Or I can't get out of work. Can't someone sign for me? You know, really meet with those clients and let them understand, you know, you're buying a piece of real estate. It's a major transaction. You need to be available that day. And again, the time to kind of get that issue out on the table when it's easy to deal with is at this P&S stage, not a week before the closing when they tell you they're getting ready to go on the Royal Majestic for a week and thought it would just be okay. And then the other thing to really kind of look here is, you know, where are you going to host the closing? And I think we can talk more about this when we get to that end stuff, the how COVID has affected our closings and where we are doing closings now. But how we do closings has changed. And I think one of the subtitles of this class used to be the smooth sound of keys sliding across the table. And I think what we're going to talk about is just, you know, where closings are happening and who's attending them are very different now than they were 2 years ago. But again, it's just, this is the stuff you just want to hit at that moment, not closer to the closing. This provision about, you know, possession of the premise can come up and can really hurt you if you don't look at it. You know, if you have a client buying a multifamily, what does it say about tenants? What does it not say about tenants? What do the people think is supposed to happen to tenants? The other thing we're seeing a lot of now in today's market, sellers are selling, but then entering a use and occupancy agreement to stay behind on the property for 30 or 60 days while they look to buy something else. So you're going to want to know that. That's going to generate a whole other agreement called a use and occupancy. You have to negotiate that out. I like to get the agreement sorted out then, but I don't like to sign it then. I like to wait to sign it at closing. So Christine, Jim, and Sarah, what are your thoughts on that? When do you like your clients to sign use and occupancies?
I would like them to never sign use and occupancies.
Okay, so that's Sarah Supple. Title Insurance doesn't want to hear this stuff, but in the practical world, we have them. at what moment in the transaction do you like your clients to sign these things?
So I'm 50-50 with you on doing it at closing or at PNS. Okay. I guess if we know for sure that the seller needs the use and occupancy, like it's not a just in case type of thing, I prefer to have it done at the purchase and sale agreement just so that everything is right there and it's done completely. But if, you know, they're just kind of planning for this, like they think they're going to find a house or they'll have, you know, another place to go, so we're not sure, this is a just in case thing, then I'm with you. But I like to have it drafted ahead of time so that there's no confusion as to what the terms are going to be when it comes time to actually execute it.
No surprises.
Agree. Yep.
Jim, do you agree with that?
100% agree. Yeah, we do it 50% of the time. But the important thing, I think, is to make sure that there's a clear understanding, especially for the closing, of what the terms are going to be. Is it going to be a security deposit? You know, I think the earlier you can flush that out, the better. But yeah, I agree with Christy on that.
Yeah. Anyway, and I agree. I'm glad that I got those responses because it's what I was hoping to get out of you. And, you know, one of the big things is a lot of times the realtors will help create, oh yeah, the seller wants to use an occupancy. Then we come in and start talking about things like security deposits or what's the fee.
Insurance.
And all of a sudden people are like, you know, how are we doing final readings? When's that going to happen? So walkthroughs. Realtors are like, you know, when do we do the walkthrough? Like, when they leave. So those things bring up a lot of nuances that we end up usually bringing to the table for the first time. And, you know, realtors and clients can be surprised. There's so much to it.
So I add one more thing to that too.
Yep.
So the other thing is if the buyer is buying the property as their primary residence and the lender knows about the use and occupancy, they're going to want to see what the terms are, because if they're buying it as their primary residence at the time of closing, they're going to have to sign an affidavit stating that they intend to occupy the property within 60 days of closing. Right. So if these people have been creative and are giving them 90 days or 4 months until, you know, school's out, you know, the lender might have an issue with that.
Right. And that's, you know, another issue, we have to bring that up. And well, what are you talking about? Well, you're going to sign a mortgage that says you're going to move in within 60 days. How can you do this for 4 months? So you're right. You have to be creative and figure it out. But again, I hope that this discussion is highlighting this theme I'm having of the best time to work these things out is at this purchase and sale agreement stage, at the beginning, before you have the pressure of time and it closing looming on you and people are further down the road and emotions are running differently. Mm-hmm. So that's that paragraph. When we get to the provisions of the purchase and sale agreement that talk about what happens when we get to closing and the seller can't close, not because they couldn't move out, not because they're just not ready, you know, for a real reason, like there was a title problem, there was physical damage to the property. So they can't deliver what they're supposed to deliver to you. The agreements are going to have an automatic extension that's either going to go 30 days or less if there's a mortgage and the rate expiration is before then. But this is one of those things when you have a buyer, especially, you want to talk to your client and let them know there's a chance of a problem. If the problem happens, this language is going to kick in. You don't really have a choice. You have to give them time to cure the problem. We can put some limits on it and we can try and save damages a certain amount. We get out, but let them understand this because it's one of the only automatic extensions built into an agreement. For the most part, you know, if we have to change time, it's an ask and they have to accept. So it's an offer and an acceptance, but this is one of those automatic ones. Depending on which version of the purchase and sale agreement you're using, when you're in this provision, you're going to want to look for certain language. If you see words like may, elect, you want to, you know, change that to shall, because you want the seller to have to fix the problem and extend, not use some older language that still survives that says the seller may fix it or may cancel the transaction. You really want to see that language, spot it, and change it to the shall or sell, shall take reasonable measures to fix the property. So that's just kind of being keenly alert to what agreement you're looking at and looking to ensure to make you have the right language there moving forward. Because again, you don't want to get caught when this problem arises. You didn't catch it. Now the seller's like, hey, there's a problem. I'm electing to end the transaction. You will not look good in that situation to your clients or the lender. Another part of the same paragraph that often happens when you have a seller, you want to put some language in that would limit the amount of money the seller would have to pay to clear a title defect. I think the standard still is 0.5% of the purchase price. But I think a lot of attorneys just put like $1,000 in and sneak that past the goalie sometimes. I always try and look for that and edit it out to that 0.5%. And sometimes I try and do more if I'm a buyer. But as a seller, you know, make sure it's in there, make sure it's reasonable. You don't want your seller on the hook for an unlimited amount of expenses. At the same time, you want, you know, something reasonable to the buyer. And then I mentioned this, but I'll explain it a little further. You got to protect the buyer's rate lock. So if it's one of those agreements that just says you're going to extend for 30 days, well, what happens if the buyer's rate lock expires in 20? You got to put some limiting language in that would say it's 30 days or sooner if the buyer's rate lock expires. Another version of it is 30 days or one business day before the buyer's rate lock expires. So just spot that language, get it out there. And, you know, make sure you're tracking and protecting who your client is. Another fun change I like to make, and I see a lot of times, you know, the language says, you know, the buyer accepting the deed makes the transaction official. I think you'll see most of us change acceptance to recording, right? Because in Massachusetts, it's when you record the deed that matters. So it's just a little subtle change and you know, really gets in that agreement when the transfer is official, not when they have the deed in hand, but when we go to record with it, because that's when it's official. You know, just want to pause here for a second. Are you guys seeing this new thing where sellers' side are demanding wire transfers before you record or anything? Are you seeing these types of things?
You're going to see that on foreclosures and REO, real estate owned.
So I'm starting to see that bleed a little bit. I've had a couple of attorneys kind of tell me I have to initiate the seller's wire. They'll hold it in escrow before they'll release the deed to me. And it's been awesome to fight that fight.
Yeah. And that's a little bit of the gap spillover from COVID too.
Yep.
And it's a fight you fight. You're going to fight it with foreclosures. You're going to fight it with REO. You're going to fight it with new condos. You're going to fight it with developers.
Yeah. So, and you're going to talk about gap later on, right? Is that on the agenda for the title insurance part?
It's not, but I can add it.
Yeah, we'll definitely cover it maybe in COVID.
Remind me. Yeah. Right. I love a good gap discussion.
And one thing too I've run into with angry sellers.
Yes.
Is the buyer getting into the recording of the deed, the buyer getting into the property, moving their belongings, and the seller does not have their funds. Delays in wiring are an issue. I think that's something I try to be mindful of, and I even try to throw something in the P&S that usually doesn't get rejected too many times, but that the seller shall have access to the property upon recording and receipt of proceeds.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, again, the contract is fulfilled upon recording, but you have angry sellers that do not like people in their house, especially when they do not have hundreds of thousands of dollars. So,
and then just to digress even further down this little rabbit hole, the other thing I'm seeing a lot of is we're on record, the buyer has keys, we've initiated the wire, right? But it's in wire land, or it's an overnight. So the check has to get delivered overnight. And the seller will say, I'm not releasing the keys until I have the money in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can't blame them. I mean, if it's his lawyers, think of the liability. If the seller's still on the hook for their insurance, why would you want other people in your house?
So can we just pause for a second? I can fly through the rest of my stuff because I think this is important. My understanding, and if I'm proven wrong in public, it won't be the first time. Once I'm on record, the buyer owns the house.
Correct.
So
whether the seller has money or not.
Correct.
So we do have a statute that says recording is presumed as delivery. So the delivery of the deed between the parties is when the party owns the property, whether it's on record or not. The recording of it is just so the third parties in the world know about the transfer, and so you're not subject to any kind of liens that might occur. However, even, and you and I, we all know that even though this happens, a lawsuit can still be filed. Yes, and insurance companies can still get engaged. So if I was a seller, and even though we're on record, I would say I need my money that second. And if I don't have my money that second, I didn't deliver the deed, even though it's presumed delivered by statute. I didn't do it until I got my money.
So what I love that this is illustrating is there's four conveyances here. And you can just see how we all kind of have little twists and turns and think of things differently. And we can kind of agree on things. We're not disagreeing, but try and find different loopholes on it. And that's just one issue. Right. And I think your viewpoint would change if you're a seller or if you're a buyer or if you're a lender. But these are real issues. And all three of those things we just talked about happen. They happen regularly.
And Jonathan, the viewpoint changes with the new case law.
True. You know,
like we all go along the same way of how we think. And then there's a case that changes the way we think.
Yep.
And I was just going to say, too, there's case law on certain provisions of the P&S that have been addressed. But there's also the lack of case law on a lot of the provisions of the P&S. So until we have that, till we have case law to tell us, we're just
100%. And I wish we did. If I could name like five topics that I wish we had a good case on, I could. Alas, we do not, because nobody's making money by suing each other.
No, not at all.
Well, and I think too, as conveyancers, like part of what we need to do with our sellers, and this is what I do anyway with my sellers, is to make sure that they understand if they're getting a wire transfer that the attorney generally should be sending out the wire as soon as the deed goes on record. But once that wire's gone out, like the attorney has no control when the receiving bank gets it. Banks have different cutoff times. It has to go through the Federal Reserve. We don't know what the Federal Reserve is doing with the wire in between, you know, it hitting the person's bank account. And then if they do want to check, I get the complaints, you know, when they deposit their check, their bank puts a 5-day hold on it because it's such a large sum of money. So it's like, you know, it sucks for the seller. So I try to make sure my clients understand, like, one, if you need the funds right away, you're going to have to do a wire transfer. And everybody thinks a wire transfer is immediate, but unfortunately, it's not always the case. Should be same day, but depending on when it goes out, you know, you might not get it till the next business day. So I just try to make sure that they understand, you know, it's not the buyer's fault, you know, and generally, you know, Jonathan is sending out the wire as soon as that deed's recorded. So it's not Jonathan's fault. Like, this is now in, you know, money heaven, like getting into their account. So
yeah, you know, and it's a really good point. And again, I think the point you just highlighted is kind of this, the theme of this part. It's educate your side of the transaction. And sometimes it's not just limited to your client. It's also educating your client's realtor. Make sure they're aware of things. So that's great. When you get to the deposit section, I would argue, you know, one of the most important things in the purchase and sale agreement is to safeguard that deposit in case the agreement falls apart. Who keeps that giant sum of money that someone saved up all this time for? And you want to, you know, make sure that the language, you know, is there. So you're looking for things like mutual written direction of the parties or a court order. You're going to see a lot of people take a court order and really put some fine language on it, like a final order from a court of competent jurisdiction with all appeal periods having told. That sounds so awesome and legal. But, you know, make sure that language is there. Make sure if you see the escrow agent may hold the deposit, you're scratching out may and making it shall. You don't want one person being the arbiter of what happens to that money if the transaction falls through. Default damages, you know, when I show this to first-time home buyers, they gasp that, you know, they could lose their deposit. And when you get into the idea of, you know, this is a savings clause, if we didn't have this language, your damages could be more severe. They calm down. But, you know, here's some stuff on the screen that you generally want to look for and make sure is in there. To button up that, I'm just going to move a little quicker to some of these lesser important ones, guys. But if you see something, you know, yell up that you want to pause on any of this stuff. Mortgage contingency clause. If your client is getting a mortgage, you got to make sure this clause is locked down. Again, there could be some math here. I'm seeing more offers come through. Instead of telling me what the contingency is, it's written as a percentage. And I think as attorneys, we don't want that. We want the amount. So we're converting, we're doing math. I went to law school to avoid math, but yet here I am doing conveyancing work. You know, go figure. Check the dates. not only check the dates, but look where you are in the calendar and make sure your bank can meet those dates. Because a lot of times the offer will come through and the seller accepts it because they put down unreasonably quick mortgage contingency and closing dates. So don't just say that's fine. You know, check the lender. You know, can you meet these deadlines? Because again, if they can't, now's the time to fix it. You don't want to wait to the day of the contingency and then start asking to extend if you can do it back on day one because your lender told you that they could not do it. You just really want to avoid that as much as you can. I don't know about you guys, but 9 times out of 10, I always try and take time away from work on a day there's a mortgage contingency deadline. And even though I address it well ahead of time, something always pops up and my day off is getting interrupted because we have to address these things. It's without fail, just as without fail. The other thing I really do want to pause here on as we start to kind of segue out of my segment is, you know, in the market today, a lot of people are waiving their mortgage contingency to make themselves a more attractive buyer, but they're pursuing a mortgage. And this can cause a lot of problems for both sides because some sellers and realtors on that side don't understand that just because I'm not pursuing a mortgage doesn't mean an appraiser, you know, they cannot let an appraiser look at a house. Buyers don't understand that just because they waive the provision, they're getting a mortgage, the seller doesn't have to automatically extend when their bank can't meet a closing date and their deposit is at risk because they waive this contingency. So I often find myself in a huge educational stance when I see these offers. I'm really explaining to the buyer what this means in real time.
Recording in progress.
Because all they heard before that was, to make yourself more attractive, you have to waive your mortgage contingency. You're going to qualify for a mortgage. It'll be fine. That's what they're getting. Then we get to come in and say, well, this is what this means in real life. And it's not a fun conversation to have, especially if they don't really know what's happening, but you have to have it. As a seller's attorney, when I see offers come in that waive the mortgage contingency, I try and get language in a purchase and sale agreement that says, you know, affirmatively, they are or are not pursuing a mortgage. If, you know, I might ask, can we have proof of funds? Because I want to know, because if they're getting a mortgage but waive the clause, I'm going to give my seller client and my seller realtor some different advice. Because again, they're going to operate from the position of they waived the mortgage. You know, why does the appraiser want to get in? They're so offended. There's an appraiser coming. It's like, yeah, they waived the mortgage. They waive their ability to save the deposit if the lender can't close. And I think the other thing that happens is, you know, you get down that road and they have to extend and everyone is aghast when the seller's like, I'm not extending. And they just can't believe they wouldn't extend. Like, you made an offer. I accepted it. This wasn't part of it. So that's,
I had a client, Jonathan. Oh, sorry, Jonathan. I had a client and it was a seller client and the buyer waived and said it was cash and nobody said anything about a mortgage. And supposedly they had the cash to buy, but lo and behold, they had a great deal with the mortgage and wanted to come in and do an appraisal. And my clients were afraid that if the property didn't appraise, that they were going to just walk and leave their deposit. So yeah, they literally refused to allow the appraiser into the property. Yeah. I had the loan officer calling me. He works with all the attorneys in my office. And I'm like, I can't force my clients to let an appraiser when the buyer waived the mortgage contingency. So it literally kind of like blew up the deal.
Let me ask you a finer point question then. Did that, so for a lot of people that are really new to this, one of the provisions that we build into a purchase and sale agreement is an access clause, right? Mm-hmm. Pre-closing access. And it allows the buyer or buyer's representatives certain times or certain number of times to get into the property before the closing with different things. If you have no mortgage contingency, do you go in and edit that paragraph to exclude appraisers?
I do.
Jason said yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I represent the buyer, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And why? That's the most important question for the folks to hear. Why do you do that?
For this situation.
All right. The seller has to let them in the property.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Exactly. So getting back into the P&S, where we wrap up is, you know, honestly, no matter what agreement you see, whether it's an attorney crafted one, whether it is one of the pre-form ones, you're going to have a buyer's addendum and you're looking in to fill some of the holes that you don't see in the different standard form agreements and the different attorney ones. And I just kind of, you know, listed them there. It's pretty self-explanatory.